Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
We are doing true crime today, sort of, in a political way, which I guess that's the same thing. Now, and we've got an author who was involved in some of the stuff. And let's just get right to him. His book is called Dirty Trickster, Corporate Spy, and it's Martin D. Kelly. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be hanging by my tail upside down like a bat, as you mentioned.
In the bat cave.
I'm in the bat cave. Yep.
In the bat cave, yeah. Yeah, all alone. All the others are sleeping. They all get a day off.
That just smells terrible, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, you get used to it.
I guess.
You get used to it. So, listen, let's talk. This is the first time you've been on our show, so let's talk about you.
All right. Get
into you. So, where do you hail from, and kind of what's your background before we get into the book?
Well, briefly, I was a military brat. My dad was a World War II fighter pilot, and he remained in the Air Force after the war. And I was born on a military base in Japan and went with the family to bases in Germany and Texas and Alabama and Wyoming, Florida. You know how military families go one place to another every 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And that's probably why one of my favorite pastimes is traveling. And I've been fortunate enough to have visited many countries over the years, and in my semi-retired role these days as a travel writer. But I spent most of my years here in Florida, where I am now, and I obtained a BA while attending the University of Miami while on a golf scholarship. So I did write a couple of books previously. I was involved in journalism as it relates to the outdoors, fishing and hunting and camping and whatnot, and have a couple of books related to that that I've also penned.
Well, that's interesting. You were the fisherman. Yeah. I saw that a couple of books.
Yeah.
And you survived Alabama, so you've been through the worst.
Well, yeah, pretty much. Montgomery. We were in Montgomery, Alabama. But, it's a beautiful state. Squirrels, just bountiful game of deer and whatnot. So, we were in Montgomery for about 3 years. It was quite interesting.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it is pretty. So how did you get involved with the whole dirty tricksters? Like, that's a saying that really goes along with Nixon and
True. And
Watergate.
True.
That's sort of like, if someone said dirty trickster, his picture goes into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
How did you get involved with that campaign to begin with?
Well, it sort of has a backstory. I mean, I always enjoyed practical jokes when we were, you know, when I was a kid. And as a quick for instance, when we were at Homestead Air Force Base south of Miami back in the 60s, our phone number was one digit off from the base motor pool where they provided cars to people visiting who, you know, would fly in, the bigwigs. And because our number was one digit off, we would oftentimes get mistaken calls to our house to provide a car. And my dad kept telling them that, and they wouldn't change the number. So whenever I was alone in the house and a call came in from some hotshot asking for a car, I'd pretend to be an airman at the motor pool. And even at my age of 16, my voice sounded like an adult. So the conversation would go like this. This is Colonel Williams from the Pentagon. I need a car delivered to the visiting officer's quarters immediately. Yes, sir. It'll be there in 10 minutes. About 20 minutes later, the phone rings. Hey, this is Colonel Williams. Where in the hell's the car I requested? Supposed to be here 10 minutes ago, and I'm going to be late for a meeting. Oh, sorry, Colonel. I had to go number two. I'll be right over with the car. Then I'd hang up again. And the next time Colonel Williams called, he wasn't calling to say Merry Christmas.
No.
And after that played out many times, they finally changed the motor pool number, but they didn't catch up with me. So I had a kind of a penchant for silly tricks and things such as that. And my dad was not a political person in the sense of being a candidate or active in the party, but he had a Republican heritage. And he commented often at the dinner table about different things happening in the country and whoever was president, and et cetera. So when I got into college, while I was playing golf, I became involved in the College Republican Organization and ended up being the statewide chairman of the group. We had about 20, 30 different campuses that were organized with clubs. So I got contacted by Don Segretti by actually two people. One was a friend in Miami of mine who had worked as an advance man for Nixon in 1968, and Segretti had contacted him from a list of that, and he'd mentioned me. And the other was a guy named Bob Benz, a Republican Party operative in Tampa, who had met through the Young Republican Organization. So Segretti needed someone based in Miami because that's where all the headquarters for the Democratic candidates running for president had their main headquarters for the state base there. And as it turned out, although many people took part in small ways with the dirty tricks effort during Watergate, only Bob Benz, Segretti, and myself were paid from a slush fund kept by Nixon's personal attorney, a fellow named Herbert Kalmbach. And we were the only three witnesses to later testify before the Senate Watergate Committee on the subject of dirty tricks during the 1972 Democratic presidential primaries. And Don had called me and said he'd like to meet. He sounded very mysterious. He called himself Donald Simmons, not Donald Segretti. He gave me a false name. And he asked me what I thought about negative campaigning. And even at that young age, and in my limited contact and campaigns that I'd been involved in, I could see that negative campaigning seemed to emote people a lot more than positive campaigning. So my natural answer was to say, well, it has a great impact. So he said he was from a rich family and went to Harvard, and now he just wants to help in the political process to sow some disunity in the Democratic rivals running for president. There were 16 different Democrats running. So Segretti is kind of, I met him at a hotel for lunch, and he's only about 5'2". He's a real little guy, dressed in a jacket tie, sort of this boyish face, even though he was close to 30. And he talked in hushed tones. It was all very, very mysterious, and it intrigued me. Obviously, now when I look back, I wish I'd have told him to shine my shoes and take off and forget it, you know. But instead, I succumbed to the dark side, you might say. And he called me for a couple, 3 weeks after that, and then that's when I just sort of gradually started taking part in things like counter demonstrations with signs from different candidates. Like if Muskie was having a rally, show up with a group of college Republicans holding signs for a different candidate, such as for Humphrey or for John Lindsay, who was the ex-mayor of New York City running, or Shirley Chisholm, or any one of the many characters, Scoop Jackson from Washington, just to make it look like they were supporters of another group there. And so I didn't jump into the deep end. I just sort of stuck my big toe into the shallow end and then emerged deeper and deeper until I was one of the dirty tricksters.
Yeah. Did you realize that you were doing this for, in a roundabout way, Nixon and the White House?
I strongly suspected it. Donald Segretti did not tell me that. His stock answer when I would say, obviously this isn't being organized by the White House gardener. This is a lot larger scope and flying around the country and providing money. And I said, I suspected strongly it was coming from either the committee to reelect the president or directly from the White House. And Don would just say, I don't know. And then finally, when we got to know each other better after 4 or 5 months of collaborating, he said, I'll tell you what, after the election's over, we'll sit down over a beer and I'll tell you the whole story. And so that's when I knew that, in fact, he was dealing directly with the White House, and I was indirectly through him.
So when you look back at this now, how do you feel about doing the things that you were involved with? Like, do you feel like you were used, or do you feel like part of the scenario? I guess you were, but where does it sit with you now?
Well, you know, I'll give myself this. I was a very ambitious young college guy who was getting very fascinated by the political process. I was moving up fast in the chain of Republican activists. I'd already won the statewide convention for college Republican. And I was just overly ambitious. I really didn't use very, very good judgment. And I've regretted it 1,000 times. I am not a supporter of those type of activities. And frankly, that's the purpose of my book mainly, there's a lot in there about party activism and maneuvering and different things you do at a convention as opposed to an election. And I state over and over again that don't succumb to the insalubrious side of politics, the dark side, because that becomes you. Had I not been caught in Watergate, I would have probably gone to law school at the expense of the Republican Party. I would have probably been a political operative. I may have run for office. And in retrospect, I would have had no moral compass. I would have probably felt that the ends justify the means no matter what. And that's not what democracy is about. And I don't say that loosely or in a corny way. I feel that way truly. I in a way, I was saved by the Watergate break-in and then everything else becoming divulged through phone records and testimony, et cetera, et cetera. So while I retired at a really early age from politics, you might say, it taught me a lesson that sometimes you need to step back, think things through, sort of get a vision for the consequences of what you're going to do and not make a bad decision. And so I very much regret my involvement in it. At the same time, it's a story that needs to be told. There's never been anybody from directly the Dirty Tricks Brigade, you might say, that has written anything about it, a book. So I reveal and tell all about the different capers we did and how they were planned and how they were executed. And it's quite fascinating, I think, and shocking even, to what extent we went to try to get the candidates, the Democratic candidates, backbiting each other and blaming each other for these different weird things going on. So it would be more difficult for them to unify after the convention when they pick whoever was going to run against Nixon. That was the whole purpose. So in summation, it was just a stupid thing to do. It really was. I never did anything illegal. I didn't do any break-ins. I didn't write any scurrilous letters or distribute them attributing sexual improprieties to any of the candidates, and unfortunately that had been done by others. I did stay, you know, have the sense to stay clear of that. But the things that I were doing, pranks or not, were, you know, really don't belong in the political process, notwithstanding the fact that it has been going on for, you know, ever since there's been elections, there's been skullduggery taking place and underhanded activities. But that's all a rationale. That doesn't let me off the hook, and I regret it.
I just wonder, like, what was going on in your mind, like, and I mean this in a respectful way, but I just mean, so back at the time, mm-hmm. when you were planning these things,
right?
Did you think you were hurting anybody or hurting the system, or was it just all good fun?
No, I knew I was.
Okay.
It was both. It was good fun. I mean, you know, we would laugh about some of the things that we did. Much of it sometimes ended up in the newspapers, even some of the things that took place. And I'll be glad to describe some of them, but I did know very much it was wrong, and I did know it was on the edge of legality and impropriety, and at the same time, I moved forward with it. A lot of it, again, was the ambition. I had hopes for becoming a mucky muck in the Republican Party. And certainly if you think that you are dealing with people who is in fact turned out to be involved in this, and we're talking about the White House appointment secretary, the chief of staff, the president himself, who first came up with this whole idea of a dirty tricks cabal, if you're dealing directly with them, you are jumping. You're hopscotching way over the normal route it takes for a political activist to get somewhere and to move up in the ranks. So it would have been a giant leap from a strictly political standpoint had the Watergate burglars never been caught. Having said that, as I said before, I'm glad it did happen, because that's not the kind of life I would have wanted to lead.
Yeah. Now, we've had Roger Stone
uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
on mm-hmm. the show a few times. And mm-hmm. and people like him seem to think that Watergate was just fabricated, that it's just a way of bringing down a great man, was kind of his opinion. Yeah,
I think evidence shows otherwise.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not sure how he can rewrite history.
Yeah.
In that yeah. way, because I mean, it was what it was. It's not fabricated. There's some things that were, you know, pressed upon that were kind of made out more than they are. But you know,
a lot of it. To play psychologist for a moment, was strictly because of the mindset of Richard Nixon. Here was a man who, as we all know, was vice president under Eisenhower, lost a narrow election to John Kennedy, lost an election in '62 as governor of California, and was considered a loser, pretty much. And he despised the press because the press beat him up pretty good. So when he ran in '68 and won, I think he became very arrogant. He had put together a brilliant international foreign policy team with him and Kissinger, maybe the best in history.
Right.
Domestically, you know, the domestic, the economy was rolling along pretty much despite what Nixon did or didn't do. He wasn't really noted as being a great economist. But at the same time, there was nothing egregiously bad happening with the country in terms of that. There was a turmoil from the war, but, you know, he brought it to an end. Some would say so quickly that he pretty much allowed the North to take over South Vietnam, but it did end a very contentious war under his watch. He got arrogant because he was going to win the 1972 election against probably anybody the Democrats were going to throw up. And I don't mean to say throw up in that sense. But Ed Muskie, for those who followed Watergate back then or know anything about it, was from Maine. He was tall, lanky. Some compared him to Lincoln, although facially he didn't look like Lincoln. But he was actually a pretty good candidate. And the Nixon White House and the Committee to Reelect the President, which was a group representing Nixon and the Republican Party, felt that Muskie was a threat. They felt they could beat him, but he was more of a moderate to even a moderate conservative, and that scared them a little bit. He was raising a lot of money. He was the front runner in the Democratic primaries initially, and they wanted to derail his train. And there's another little hitch to this. During Nixon's career, way back even when he ran against Helen Gahagan Douglas back in the 50s in California, there was a political operative by the name of Dick Tuck, T-U-C-K. If anyone Googles Dick Tuck, they will see that he was a brilliant trickster. He pulled all kinds of funny things that happened to Nixon during these elections, and Nixon admired him. I don't know if he liked him, but he respected him. And one day in 1971, Nixon, sitting in his office, the Oval Office, White House, he calls H.R. Haldeman, Bob Haldeman, to his office, who was his chief of staff. And the conversation, which is taped, he said, you know, I want a Dick Tuck type of operation to mess up the Democrats. So this was a revenge type of thing on his part. So Haldeman calls in Dwight Chapin, who was the appointment secretary, and explained what they wanted to do. Chapin happened to have someone in mind, a guy named Donald Segretti, who was a chum of his when they both went to the University of Southern California. So that's how Segretti got into it. That's how the whole thing started. It was really the brainchild of Richard Nixon. And I must say that some of these people who got involved in the campaign, such as G. Gordon Liddy and former CIA agents like Howard Hunt, they just took this whole thing and turned it into a murder mystery type of conspiracy. And Nixon didn't stop it. What he did know isn't certain, but he should have slammed his foot down one day and told Haldeman, says, look, I want an end to all of this nonsense. Let's just run a campaign. We've got McGovern. You know, we can try to get him as the nominee, and we can push and badmouth them by all the usual negative tricks that are used, you know, by different people. But nothing on this scale. And people breaking into Watergate to plant bugs. I mean, that was actually the second time that they had broken in. The bug went bad. They had to go back in. That was the second time they got caught in June of 1972. So, for you know, I don't know Roger Stone. I know of his background, but for him to say that this was just a something the press or the political opposition, the Democrats, used to get back at Nixon is ridiculous. I don't think there's any question. It all came from Nixon. It was directed by people from the White House, and some of those people ended up going to prison.
Yeah. I think it's just easier now because this was the early 70s, and so many people now and the last generations have no idea who Nixon was and what Watergate is.
Right.
So it's easier to spin it, I guess you would say, you know.
Well, it is. It is. And even now, Watergate is not an unusual word because people bring it up in connection with Trump and impeachment and all these other things. And it even drags Clinton into it as being the impeached in the late 1990s. And so all of these things get drummed up again. And, of course, Watergate is like the albatross that's hung around anyone's neck who's accused of doing anything wrong, that they should be impeached like Nixon.
Right.
So
it's kind of how it goes now. It's the standard. So let's tell the audience maybe one or two of your dirty tricks, like kind of what kind of an example can you give us of what you would do?
Well, all right. Probably the most celebrated one, even though it was probably the least harmful at all. I was at the going to the University of Miami. I was attending classes, and just for grins, I stopped to check out the campus bulletin board in the breezeway between the administration buildings. And all colleges, you know, have a bulletin board of people needing roommates and selling junk cars and who knows what.
Yeah.
But there was a tall, busty, blonde co-ed wearing jeans and a tight sweater standing next to me. And I said to her, you know, hoping to get a conversation going, that, hey, too bad they don't tack dollar bills up there, you know. And she sort of glanced and sighed. She says, yeah, but I need a ride to Gainesville to hang out with my boyfriend who lives up there. I don't have enough money for bus fare, and neither does he. And I said, well, maybe I can work something out. So I'd received advance word from Segretti that Senator Muskie would be in Gainesville 2 days hence for a rally at the University of Florida. And I also knew the name of the hotel where he was staying. So I kind of swallowed hard, took a deep breath, and rather timidly asked, would you do me a favor if I helped you out with a little money? And what favor? She said,
yeah.
her green eyes wide and glaring directly into me, and she definitely had the wrong idea. But I said, who do you like in the upcoming race for president? And she said, McGovern. I said, perfect. I said, you know, I'm working for McGovern, too. I said, listen, if I gave you $20, would you go to Gainesville and streak in front of Muskie's hotel and just strip off your clothes, yell, I love Ed Muskie a few times, and if anyone asks you, just give a fake name and say you're from McGovern and take off. So I opened up my wallet before she could answer, and I took out two $10 bills, and my God, she snapped them out of my hand like a chicken pecking a food pellet. She said, well, I really need to get to Gainesville. I'll do it. So I later told Seth Segretti about this unplanned rendezvous with her, and, you know, let's face it, we figured the chances of it actually happening or any press coverage would be.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
An outside shot at best. Fact is, I fully expected her not to do it. And imagine our utter shock when days later we found out that a Gainesville newspaper ran a story on the incident. And they didn't get a picture, but there were reporters right there in the lobby where he was staying, and they saw this naked girl run out yelling, "I love Ed Muskie, I love Ed Muskie." And then she got into a car and with some friend of hers, I guess, and took off. I reiterated that incident during my Watergate testimony, and the usually stoic Senator Montoya said, "You must have known her very well." And everybody in the audience laughed, and I had to tell her, well, unfortunately, no. But that was kind of an innocent type of accidental thing that happened, but it got huge, huge notoriety. But one of the more, I guess you would say, unique and well thought out, I guess you could say, plans that actually worked was Muskie was holding a press conference at a Miami hotel. So I sauntered into the hotel without much notice, clad in a full-length overcoat. It was a chilly January day. And the room staging the press conference was jammed with reporters and onlookers. In my left pocket was squirmed a Finch. I had gotten a Finch the day before, put it, and I now had it in my pocket. In the other pocket, the right one as it turns out, were two white mice. And it was not without considerable trial and error the night before. I'd inscribed two white ribbons in blue ink with the wording, "Muskie is a rat fink." So I tied the ribbons to their tails and just before entering the hotel, and I feared the little critters would chew off the ribbons. But anyway, after about 5 minutes of Muskie droning on about Miami's cultural diversity of Cuban and Haitian immigrants, and I released the Finch. And it instinctively flew toward the ceiling and thudded against a window, and the freaked out bird frantically trying to escape the din of lights and flashing cameras and all the humanity crammed into the room. And as all heads were tilted upward, I released the two mice. And it was immediate, the reaction. First came a gasp from a woman in the crowd. "A mouse," she exclaimed, and shuffled backwards, and then someone else reacted similarly. And in seconds, several of those present, they looked like monkeys on a hot plate, you know, shoving, pushing, gasping, gesturing. And Muskie looked around the room with this blank expression. I mean, he's 6'4", but his frame was tense. His fists were tightly grasping the edges of the lectern, and he knew something had happened, and it was not an accident, but he couldn't do much about it. So I anonymously called the Muskie headquarters that afternoon, posing as a distraught George Wallace supporter, and said the Wallace campaign had actually arranged that interruption of the press conference with the mice and the Finch. And therein is the gist of what we were doing. Right. It was not just the disruption. You're not going to affect that many votes. Fine, the reporters write a story the next day. That gets lost in the shuffle. What you're doing is getting Muskie ticked off that Wallace would pull that, and then after the convention, if Wallace was to win the convention or vice versa, if we pull the trick on Wallace and blame someone else, and Muskie won the thing, Muskie, whoever won the Democratic nomination would have a harder time uniting because of all these little backbiting things and stuff that was going on. Yeah. So that was the purpose of the whole brigade. But the naked girl and the Finch, the Finch and the mice were a couple. But we did most of our damage at the Washington Hilton in April of 1972. I'll be glad to tell you about that if you want. But
sure, go for it.
Okay. Well, that was one of Senator. He was still the front runner, but he was starting to lose traction. And again, there were like 16 people running. Similarly to like in 2016, remember there were 16 or 17 Republicans running at one point.
Yeah.
And one of his last major fundraising efforts occurred at the Washington Hilton. And Segretti called me before that, and he had me fly up to D.C. And we really caused total chaos with this fundraiser. It was being handled by Madeleine Albright, who turned out to be Secretary of State under Clinton years later. And she was handling it. It was on a Monday night, and it was a big-ticket item. And so what we did is we, on that day, we ordered food, liquor, flowers, and pastries. And I'm not talking about small orders, huge orders delivered to the Washington Hilton Ballroom just when guests began arriving. But this being in Washington, we called about a dozen or so African embassies and invited the ambassadors and their wives to the dinner as guests of Muskie. We then called limousine drivers to pick up the ambassadors and their wives to take them to the dinner with payment to be COD, just the same with all the liquor and the food and the flower vendors. Well, we did this, of course, posing as Muskie aides and organizers. So then we got within the eyeshot of what was happening, and angry limo drivers were threatening to pull the ambassadors out of the banquet hall if they didn't get paid. Same with the different other people who had pieces that were getting cold and other things such as that. And they're having to deal with this as guests are coming in, so it's obviously chaotic. And it caused almost international uproars because the Muskie people couldn't turn away the African ambassadors, who would have created a huge scene, and they couldn't just bring out a table and put all the black people at one table and all the other people separate. So they had to go around and create extra two spaces at tables that were made for 10, and it was extremely tight in some of those tables because about 10 or 12 of them showed up.
Yeah.
So it just was chaotic, and we had organized in Georgetown the underground demonstrators outside to be out with signs in front of the Hilton demonstrating against the fat cats who were coming in to spend all this money on a big ticket dinner instead of helping the poor. Those type of things are all going on at once, and the buzz in Washington and in the press for days after that was not the Muskie dinner having this nice affair and raising some money. It was all about all these things that were going wrong, and that's just the kind of thing that a dirty tricks operation can do. And And whenever we called anyone with the chicken places or the pizza places or the flower places or the liquor or whatever, if they needed a name, we gave them the name and phone number of somebody from the McGovern headquarters. So that's who Madeleine Albright thought did this, the McGovern people.
Right.
And she even describes it in her book, one of her books that she wrote about this chaotic dinner. So everything from that to finding out when Muskie was going to be sitting down with the editorial staff at the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times and calling ahead and saying, hey, I'm sorry, the senator's schedule's all messed up. He can't be there at 2 o'clock. Can you set it up for 1 o'clock instead? So the paper would have to get everybody together earlier than planned and get together at 1. And, of course, Muskie doesn't show up, and they sit there for an hour looking at each other. And then he bounces in. Hey, here I am for my interview. And, it looks like he's unorganized, no matter how he explains it. And that doesn't make it easy for them to recommend somebody for president when he puts the editors through that kind of thing. So just those types of little tricks add up after a while in a primary, and pretty soon the candidates were all very ticked off at each other.
Yeah.
And but those are just some of the things we did. And it was, you know, like I said, it did not impact the vote. It did not impact the Democrat, you know, the few, you put out a bunch of posters or flyers, fake brunch flyers to get people to come to a headquarters for a fake brunch. We did things like that. Those don't affect the votes. It affects instead the attitudes of the candidates toward each other. And even half or 1% of a point, if that makes a difference, if after the convention Scoop Jackson from Washington doesn't do what he was going to do to raise money, or one of the other people running just decides, you know, he really stuck it to me at the, during the primaries. I'm not going to go to bat for him or her. And that could make all the difference in the general election against Nixon.
Yeah, kind of. It takes away the unity.
It does. And, of course, they nominated McGovern, and he slaughtered McGovern in the general election, which shows this whole operation was even dumber to even spend all this money and time and effort when he easily, I think McGovern carried Massachusetts, and that was it.
Yeah. So this kind of goes on now, doesn't it? It's kind of carried on.
Well, yes, it does. You know, it depends on the mindset of the candidate. Some people are just by nature, human nature, are more paranoid or darker than others. I don't, you know, want to say anything slanderous, but there was a lot of accusations during the Republican primary in 2016 of shenanigans going on, where Dr. Ben Carson was in the race, and I think the day before, the night of the primary, he flew to Florida, and one of the candidates accused him of backing out of the caucuses. I think it was Iowa, yeah. And said, "Well, since he backed out of the caucuses, why don't you Carson people throw your vote to me?" And it was put out purposely by the top campaign people of that candidate to perpetrate that false rumor. And by the time Carson could get it straightened out, a lot of people had been affected. Well, gee, why am I going to throw my vote away for Carson if he withdrew? So things like that are absolutely still going on. And there was something in the paper a week or two ago of a candidate, I think in Oregon or whatever, who was caught by the police taking a stick and knocking down the campaign signs of his opponent. and that was a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
So,
well,
it is.
So why do these candidates think they need to have this sort of thing going on? Is it just insecurity? Because when you talk about Nixon, he didn't need to do that with McGovern in 72.
That's right.
Right? I mean,
that's right.
So was he just really insecure, or was it?
Yes. It's a win at any cost type of thing. Whether you're a candidate who's lost, especially, have lost a few elections and your ego just can't take another hit, I think some people are willing to jump over the cliff no matter what the consequences are, and obviously they hope not to get caught at it. And, politics brings out the bright side and the dark side of people. There are plenty of elected officials and candidates out there with the right intentions, who do want to serve the public, who have the best interests of the country at heart, and there are those who don't. And unfortunately, some of them get elected, and some of them do it by being underhanded and not playing fair. And it's human nature less than just the political game. You get this in business as well as politics. People climbing the corporate ladder sometimes will do whatever they have to do to undermine whoever might get that position ahead of them. So it goes back to leaders, pharaohs, killing their older brother in order to get the crown, you know?
Yeah. There's something about holding the power.
Yep.
You know,
now it corrupts.
Yeah,
it corrupts.
Totally. And
yep.
The thing is, it's gone so far now, you have to wonder, because these things stick with people. Stories and things that happen, and you're kind of, you know. So Don Segretti, whatever happened to him, and do you still know him or talk to him?
Well, Don did serve 4.5 months in Lompoc prison in California he pleaded guilty to 2 or 3 misdemeanors, I think was sentenced to 6 months and got out in 4.5. Stayed in California, went down to Southern California, south of L.A., I think Newport, I'm not sure which, but started got his law license back. He was an attorney and has practiced law ever since. Now, in 1995, just for the fun of it, he decided to run for a judgeship. And the L.A. Times found out and just went berserk and and just absolutely crushed him. So he withdrew his candidacy, and I think that was his last foray into politics. But Don and I have stayed in touch over all these years. He stayed at my house here in Florida. I have stayed at his house in California. Our wives know each other. He was down here last year. Last May, he was down here. Year ago, May. And well, we trade phone calls and emails back and forth, et cetera. So Don's a really good guy. He knows that he also made a very bad decision, and he greatly regrets it. And, you know, he's turned his life around, and he's a very productive member of society. He's been practicing law and ever since and has done very well. And his wife, Liza, is a sweet and charming person. Their daughter's doing great. Also in the field of law, so you know, Don's certainly rebounded greatly from those days, and while it'll always follow him around, it follows him; it doesn't lead him.
Yeah, and I guess so when you left politics and retired from that career, I'll say.
Yep.
You know, you went into corporate consulting and securities. What was the difference? Like, how was the changeover? So, or is it is it still the same? It's still kind of.
You know, the whole thing with it's kind of ironic, isn't it, to go from doing things on the edge of illegality to consulting on security. But my dad had been involved after he was a pilot in security in law enforcement in the Air Force. So that kind of got my interest probably too, inheriting that part of it. And I, when I got out of the Watergate stuff ended in 1974, all the hearings and committees and what have you, I took a job as an undercover investigator. And that meant that I was being hired into a company to work as a regular employee and spy on the employees and see what's going on. Is there stealing? Is there drug use? Is there gambling? What do they think about their jobs? Is all these type of things would go into a report, and then after being there for 6 or 8 or 12 weeks, I'd go on to another company and do the same thing. And it's perfectly legal. It's called undercover investigations, and it's very prevalent in industry. The company's doing it. And pretty soon I had my own company, a consulting company based in Miami, and then I ended up with 3 offices and 17 employees, and I'm doing polygraph testing and interrogations, interviews, you might say, to find out who stole any or all of the missing $500 from a bank, say.
Yeah.
And then I picked up a rather unique service, which is technical surveillance countermeasures, which is a long-winded word for eavesdropping detection. I acquired the equipment and obtained the training to look for listening devices, clandestine listening devices, such as transmitters and telephone taps and hidden microphones and hidden TV cameras and transponders that can follow cars and airplanes. And I did that all over the world and did very well with it. Yeah. So even though I moved since then to where I'm at now, which is in Tampa Bay area, west coast of Florida, I'm still doing some of that consulting for companies, and I've had quite an interesting array of clients over the years.
Yeah, I bet. And it looks like it, actually. I was looking over the list. Quite a variety of people.
Yep.
Anyone that sticks out for you that you want to talk about?
Yeah. Well, I can. These activities were back in the 80s, and some of these celebrities were even then in their 50s and 60s. So they're not around anymore. Otherwise, I wouldn't be quite so willing to toss their names out for purposes of confidentiality. But Frank Sinatra was one of my clients, and he wanted me to come out and do a sweep. One of his security people had read an article I wrote for Security Management Magazine about countermeasures, debugging. And so he got a hold of me, and I came out, and I swept Frank's place down in Palm Springs. He had a one-floor spread and sort of out in the middle of where he could walk out to his pool, and it'd be, he owned all the acreage around it, so it's not like some paparazzi could sneak up and get a picture of him. So I came in, and he was at the pool. So they led me in, and I went out to the pool, and he gets out of the pool, and I was shocked. I mean, it looked, his shoulders were like 5 inches from his neck on each side. You could see his rib bones. God, he couldn't weigh more than 125 pounds. I'm not tall. I'm 5'9". He was shorter than me. And, you know, obviously when he got dressed up, he probably had padded suits and elevator shoes. But I mean, he looked like a total wuss. I mean, just he was nothing. Anyway, we sat down and talked, and I immediately told him, you know, I admired some of his songs like My Way, and he was very cut and dried. He, look, pal, I didn't bring you out all the way out of here from Miami to talk about my career. I want you to go, blah, 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 blah. That was his attitude.
Yeah.
And he ended up saying, let me tell you something, pal. I know how some of you guys work, and if you come up with a bug, and you planted it there yourself to try to get more business, you will not be in very good shape after that, you know. The implied threat that I'd get my butt kicked. So anyway, so I did the sweep for him. I didn't find anything wrong. And his attitude changed a little bit. We went back out to the pool, and he says, all right, pal, well, nice job. Send the report to whoever it was. And Luigi, his henchman. And I'll get you some more business. Well, he did. He set me up with Dean Martin, and I went to Dean Martin's residence, and Dino was just about as nice as they get, just opposite, you know. And he even said, I really didn't want to do this, but, you know, Francis insisted I do it, so I'm just going to do this to make him happy. Go up in my office, check around, do what you want. And just, he was all laid back and easygoing in a robe and slippers, eating a bag of Doritos. And so I went up, did his office, and came back down. He offered to have me stay if I wanted to stay and chat. And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking in my head, my gosh, this guy's a superstar. I wouldn't mind sitting down and postponing my flight. So I told him, well, I'd love to chat with you. He says, no. He said, I've got to go somewhere, but you can hang out here for a while until your flight. So I just said no. So he drove me to the airport. But what a nice guy. I mean, he was just like, you picture him, just a laid back, easygoing, smiling, friendly fellow. Bob Hope, I did his hotel room in London. And unfortunately, I didn't get to meet him. He was doing a performance, and so I just had to talk to his masseuse. It seems that he had a masseuse travel with him, and 24/7. He got massages every day because of the he'd get really, really stiff from all the air flights and moving about, and he was constantly getting neck and shoulder massages and all that kind of thing. Kind of an interesting nuance.
Yeah.
And I did President Marcus, his family residence mansion in outside of Manila in the Philippines, and a lot of work for probably some bad people. I mean, I had a guy come in one time with a jacket tie attaché case and said he wanted his plane checked down in the Bahamas. Yeah. And I told him, I said, I don't do anything illegal, you know, blah, blah, blah. He said, no, I'm legit. So we flew down. It turned out to be a DC-6. And I had to climb up into the fuselage. There were no seats. Just plywood slats and marijuana residue everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, if the DEA is doing a surveillance on this, I am going to end up in prison. I'll never believe I didn't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
So I checked the plane. I found two transponders in it. I got back. They called me to do more work, and I told them I couldn't do it. I begged out because, you know, your rear end is worth more than a few thousand dollars.
Yeah, you don't know you don't know where it'll end, you know. It's just like... Wow, you've had an interesting life and met a lot of people.
Yeah, indeed.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, pretty much. It's been that's why I wanted to finally put it in book form, and you know, I tell it all. I don't hold back any names, and it's I think it's pretty pretty interesting. I am a writer, so it's not too hard to read for people, and it's over 400 pages, and it'll be out August 1st publicly, but you can pre-order it at Amazon, Dirty Trickster Corporate Spy, and priced right, $18.95.
Excellent.
And I add my email address in there, too, if anyone reads the book and wants to call me a dirty name or what
yeah,
have you there.
Hey, and we'll post it. We'll post it for everyone if you want.
That's fine. That's yeah, fine. No, never know.
So, and, yeah, so the book is on pre-order sale now. We have it up right on our website as well.
Oh, great. Great.
Again,
great.
Martin D. Kelly, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure, and I just hope that girl who was watching the at the University of Miami, that blonde one, is hearing this, and she gets my email and wants to go to Gainesville again.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.